The Pat Kenny Show.
With Matter Private Network.
On News Talk.
Now, with Culture Night just around the corner, there are many events planned to take place up and down the country. From art, architecture, to comedy, music, handcrafting, sports and science. There's something for everybody to enjoy and to attend next Friday. And tell us a bit more of what's planned and the importance of Culture Night. I'm joined by Maureen Kennelly, who is Director of the Arts Council, and by Tony Walsh, who is Curator of the Irish Queer Archives. Maureen, for those unfamiliar, though after, 17 years, there can't be many, what is Culture Night?
It is a national moment of celebration, of showcasing everything that Ireland has to offer in its artistic landscape. And it's a truly national event. You mentioned, Anton, there are many events. In fact, at last count, we'd over 1,700 events. And last year, when we were still in the midst of semi-restrictions with COVID, we'd 1.1 million people engaging with it. So we're expecting to top that figure this year.
I realise, as Director of the Arts Council, you have to love all your children equally, but give us some highlights.
You're right, but there are so many highlights, too many to mention. But I would like particularly to mention Wood Quay, where there's a really family-friendly range of events, from Bollywood dancing and the Memory Lane Choir.
Wood Quay, of course, being long associated with Bollywood dancing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So lots to offer there. Tralee will be on Fete with a late night cabaret. Tralee is a bit of a centre for circus, would you believe? So there is a fantastic group down there called the Fanzini Brothers. So there'll be late night hijinks in Tralee Town Park and film screenings. Similarly, there's a late night cabaret in Clonmel. Very much a national event.
And I assume for the whole family, there will be events that the kids will enjoy. Yeah. There'll be events that are for adults.
Absolutely. Something I'd love to mention is that at On Post in Andrew Street, the fantastic Children's Books Ireland will be present with their book doctors. So you can go in with your child and say, OK, I like this sort of flick. I like that sort of book. What do you think I should read next? And the Children's Books Ireland doctor will send you a prescription and send you into your library or into your next nearest bookshop to get your prescription filled.
Where do you draw the line as to what counts as culture? Because as I mentioned, you have architecture in here, there's comedy in here, there's sport, there's science. Some of those people might say, ah, here.
It's quite wide and broad. So, for example, we have a storyteller in the Iver Peninsula in Kerry called Sean O'Leara, who will be online on the night with a travelogue about the Iver Peninsula. But Sean is a great guy. He has produced a soap opera about goats that people have been watching. 1,000 people a day have been watching this for the last number of months. So that was his lockdown thing. So, yeah, it's quite broad. I mean, that is the great thing about Culture Night, that it appeals to a very, very broad swathe of people.
When you say about goats, are there goats in it?
There are, yes.
So the cast is made up of goats?
Yes,
and the plot line revolves around the...
It does indeed. So there's lot more hijinks there involving goats.
When people want to find out about this, where do they go?
They hop onto culturenight.ie. That's really the best. There's a very good, easy, searchable database there of those 1,700 events in every part of the country.
And one of them is the one that I mentioned earlier on, which is a cultural walk hosted by Tony Walsh, who is a curator of the Irish Queer Archives. Tony, give us a bit of data about the walking tour and the significance of it.
Hi, Anton. Hi, Maureen. And I can vouch for Maureen's excitement about the range of events that are happening on the night. It always feels like Dublin's public realm is upended with people visiting spaces that they've rarely or never been into. There's always that great opportunity to just roam around the city at will. I'm going to be doing two walking tours specifically around LGBT socialization. So shining a light on the history and the personalities behind various bars, clubs, saunas and other social spaces of the 70s and 80s and the early 90s. And I actually think it's really pertinent post the pandemic that not only do we get a chance to, I suppose, homage these venues and the personalities that in many cases put extraordinary amounts of effort into realizing them, but also putting a value on these places, because what we saw during the pandemic, and it's, although it's part of a longer process, is diminution in minority social spaces. And I'm sure Maureen would have something to say about this, but there's a combination of licensing legislation, the commodification of the public realm is actually preventing people from actually opening up and vouching for the sort of spaces that are really important to building community. So I really want to not only homage and historicize a lot of these old venues, but also put a value on why we need them, why they're so important to actually building community, building society.
And I assume part of that, Tony, is to remind people of how far we've come, because it was only when you say it there, where you talk about the saunas, there will be a generation of people who will say, well, what has a sauna got to do with LGBT rights? But of course, there was a point at which that the saunas in Dublin were a hugely significant, totally underground meeting place for gay men.
You're absolutely right, Anton, and they were, precisely because, of course, you could get 2 years in prison for holding hands or kissing in public. So people, men, gay men, negotiated desire and intimacy, I suppose, in the shadows, let's describe it. So saunas provided a very important outlet for gay and bisexual men. I mean, the other thing, too, is it's not that long ago, you're absolutely right, when people were, it was the existence of the old British legislation was allowed people, justify people in their business. Bigotry, so much so that I remember being refused service with my boyfriend in a bar in Dame Street. This is only 19, doesn't feel that long ago to me. I was 20, the early 80s. We didn't have any anti-discrimination legislation, and it was legal for venues to refuse service to gay clientele or people who looked gay.
But it's funny, I was talking earlier in the show, Tony, to Kieran Casey, who's written the book, The Irish Department of Finance, 59 to 99, but in it, he has a letter which is written from a cabinet minister to George Colley, another cabinet minister, in 1979, talking about the setting up of a memorial to Roger Casement. And of course, Roger Casement was gay. And there is a line in it where he says that it would be a mistake to erect it at Sandy Cove Park because it is a well-known contact area for homosexuals in the late evenings. And the thought that Roger Casement's presence might foster gay people meeting each other was enough that the memorial didn't go ahead.
And that's a great piece of entertainment, I have to say. Somebody needs to do a play about that. Open that up into a play. That conversation is quite extraordinary. But we do need to acknowledge that these places existed and why, ask the questions why they existed. I mean, you've answered it already. They were really important to allowing people to actually meet each other. But what I also want to explore in the walking tour, I mean, I stop outside Trinity College. In fact, it's the start of the tour, and I want to remind people of the value of progressive student unions back in the 1970s, at a time, for example, when there were few of the, a small example of the body politic that were prepared to put out a hand to their lesbian and gay brothers and sisters. And in this case, progressive students union at Trinity College in 1974 offered rooms to facilitates the establishment of a group called the Sexual Liberation Movement. And great things happen from that. I always remind people that when you get a group of people who are bound by an oppressed minority status, be it religion, their skin color, their traveler identity, whatever, their sexuality, their gender, but when you get a group of people who are bound by their oppressed minority status and you put them in the room and you allow them the time, the space, to unburden their oppression, magic happens. It facilitates conversations. And from those conversations, people can actually imagine a brighter and more positive future for themselves and for society around them.
Tony, I'll tell you what, the walk sounds fascinating, and Tony's cultural walk around Dublin is part of Culture Night. CultureNight.ie if you want to find out about any of the events that are on. And I suppose, Maureen, to some extent, we have been talking about culture as an immediate and current thing, but some of what Tony's highlighting there, it does to some extent, depending on which event you go to, root us in our past, remind us of the good aspects of it, and remind us of where we have come from some of the bad aspects.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's powerful listening to Tony talk there. It's like a sense of the city peeling back the layers to look at, okay, this is where we were. Tony's is one of a number of tours. And I think that's the fascinating thing, that people just have their city or their urban centre, their rural place revealed to themselves. They just see it afresh. So it's a really powerful, motivating thing. I hope I'll get on Tony's walk. But exactly what Tony says too, spaces are threatened in the city. It's something that we're very, very concerned about at the Arts Council. We hope to be able to work in that soon with the nighttime economy.
Well, if you want to find out more, it is culturenight.ie. Big thank you to Tony Walsh, curator of the Irish Queer Archives, and of course to Maureen Kennelly, director of the Arts Council. Now, Apple is the world's most iconic company. It's also the world's most valuable, market cap of $2.5 trillion. It's had a phenomenal pandemic, but it's now facing into a cost of living crisis where customers may seek to cut back their spending on fancy devices. News Talk's deputy business editor Gavin McLaughlin is here to discuss the business of Apple. You want to start, Gavin, by talking about Tim Cook?
Yeah, I want to posit, Anton, that there's a strong case that Tim Cook has done more for Apple than Steve Jobs. When Cook took over in 2011, Apple was worth $350 billion. Now, as you mentioned, it's worth $2.5 trillion. So in terms of delivering value for Apple shareholders, there's absolutely no comparison at all. Now, Cook is not really seen as a visionary when it comes to products, but he is a visionary when it comes to operations. And obviously he's done very well at getting the most out of what they have. We've all seen the various different iterations of the iPhone, etc. The second thing I just want to say about him is, before he was the chief executive, he was instrumental in turning the company around, because for a lot of the 90s, Apple was a mess and actually was on the verge of going bust. One of the big problems they had was with the way their manufacturing was organised. So to use the jargon, they had an inventory problem. They were spending a load of money to build their stuff, but they weren't selling it quickly enough. And so you had all this sort of inventory piling up in warehouses, depreciating in value, the money wasn't coming in to pay for it, and it was just a whole mess. So Steve Jobs, who had returned to Apple in the late 90s after being ousted in the 80s, he brought in Tim Cook to sort this problem out. And Cook arrived, closed factories, outsourced production, and basically had this system where products were produced more or less as needed. And this was hugely, hugely important for the business, what Cook did.
Sorry, Gavin, you mentioned Jobs leaving and coming back. This is one of the great business stories of all time. Give us the detail of what happened.
Yeah, so he obviously was one of the founders, and the vision was to bring computers to the masses. And they did that pretty successfully. But by the mid-80s, things start to go wrong. Sales are sluggish and there's infighting. A guy called John Sculley had been brought in from Pepsi to help run the business, because Jobs was a product guy. He wasn't really a business manager, and he was a very difficult personality. And eventually there was a falling out and Jobs was essentially fired from Apple. John Sculley, he actually spoke about all this in an interview with CNN years later. He admitted it was a terrible mistake, and he said it all started when they had a disagreement over which Apple computer they should focus on.
Where it broke down was in 1985, the Macintosh Office, which is what we called it at that time, was just not powerful enough. The processor technology just wasn't there yet to be able to really be a functioning tool the way Steve had envisioned. Mm-hmm. And our disagreement was over Steve wanting to lower the price of the Macintosh. And I said that we had to leave the price of the Macintosh alone because we couldn't build any more, even if we could sell them, and that we had to focus on the Apple II. And Steve didn't want to focus on the Apple II. He wanted to focus on the Mac. We went to the board. The board did an investigation for several weeks, came back and agreed with my position, and asked Steve to step down from running the Macintosh division. You can imagine what an incredible blow it was to the founder of the company, the largest shareholder, the chairman of the board, to be told to step down from the Macintosh division. And Steve never got over that. In hindsight, it was a terrible mistake for Steve to be pushed out. I clearly was not skilled in being able to build technology products, so I had to surround myself with others. And the reality was there was no one ever as good as Steve.
Former Apple boss John Sculley with a lot of hindsight humility there. So 10 years after that, Steve Jobs brought back.
Yeah, and this is, as I mentioned, when the company was a mess, in big financial trouble, and Jobs eventually becomes CEO again and hires Cook to sort out the manufacturing and overhauls the product range. And it's around this time that a guy called Johnny Ive starts to come into his own, because Johnny Ive was the key designer. Do you remember the iMac?
Anton. Oh, yeah, the see-through yoke.
Yeah, colourful, translucent desktop computers, which people will remember. And then, of course, a few years later, the iPod. And it was these really that began Apple's reputation for great design, which, of course, is a big part of why they've been so successful.
I assume their most successful product of all time is the phone, though.
Yeah, and what I like about this is, I mean, Steve Jobs didn't invent the smartphone, but he did it better than everyone else. They had... actually had a sort of a mobile computer type thing in the 90s, which some people might remember, called the Apple Newton. But that was a failure, although I'm sure a lot of lessons were learned from it. And so when it came time to do the iPhone and they surveyed everything else out there, like the BlackBerry, for example, Jobs could see ways of getting ahead of the competition. Here's Steve Jobs explaining his thinking at the iPhone launch in 2007.
Let me talk about a category of things. The most advanced phones are called smartphones, so they say. And they typically combine a phone plus some email capability, plus they say it's the internet, sort of the baby internet, into one device. And they all have these plastic little keyboards on them. And the problem is that they're not so smart and they're not so easy to use. So. But what we're going to do is get rid of all these buttons and just make a giant screen. A giant screen.
I remember actually at the time, Gavin, looking at my BlackBerry and thinking, that giant screen, Lark, that's never going to catch on. I was Steve Jobs there speaking at the launch of the iPhone. It is the product, of course, that made them what they are today. Give us some of the financials.
Yeah, so the world's most valuable company, valued at $2.5 trillion. Their nearest rival is Saudi Aramco, which is the Saudi state national oil company, $2.1 trillion. And Aramco vies with them not just for the title of most valuable company, but also the title of most profitable. So Apple, for example, in their last financial year had net profit of $94.6 billion, although Aramco actually did $110 billion just because of what's been going on with oil prices. And Aramco also has just done $48 billion of net profit in one single quarter. But obviously the oil business is very volatile, and so despite, you know, these profits, as far as the market is concerned, there's no business more valuable than Apple.
94.6 billion, not in turnover, in just sheer profit.
Yeah.
Amazing. If they're going to keep that level of preeminence, what are the threats?
Well, if we just take a look at the last set of results, which illustrate what's going on quite well, this is for the 3 months to June 25th. So overall revenue was up 2% on the same period last year, driven by the iPhone, that was up 2%. And services, which is things like the streaming, the music, iCloud storage, revenue in that division was up 12%. Everything else basically was down. iPad revenue down, Mac revenue, the other products division, which would include the watch, that was down as well. So you have this issue where they had a good pandemic with device sales, people scrambling to get stuff for home working. But now that we've sort of come out of that period, growth is more difficult because everyone has already bought a new device. And of course, there's a cost of living crisis. But Apple and many of the analysts seem confident that the iPhone, at least the engine of the company, will continue to grow. The thinking would be, you know, people who have them tend to be quite well off. Apple is at the premium end of the market, and so their customers might be insulated a bit from the economic problems. And obviously, they're a hugely important part, iPhones are, of people's lives. So that's an incentive to spend. If we take, for example, Dan Ives, well-regarded analyst at Wedbush, probably the top tech analyst on Wall Street, he says in a recent note, demand for the iPhone is looking strong. I would just add one element of caution. I mean, if you look at Nokia or General Electric or even IBM, once great dominant companies that eventually got outflanked by the competition, this could happen to Apple as well. Maybe some company we've never heard of or one that hasn't even been thought of yet could eventually cause it to slide into irrelevance. This is the way things sometimes go.
Although the way that theoretically you avoid that happening is diversification. You get your thumbs into as many pies as is possible. In terms of new frontiers, what's Tim Cook excited about?
Well, the Apple Watch is at the center of it. It's healthcare.
I've always thought that if you want to enrich somebody's life, one of the most important things, or certainly in the top two or three, is their well-being. And I think, you know, because of a number of factors in society and so forth, people have sort of outsourced a bit of the way they feel to their doctor. Mm-hmm. And we've always been about empowering the person and democratizing things. And now all of a sudden, you can do an ECG on your wrist. Yeah. I've had both young people and older people tell me that the fall detection on here has gotten them out of a huge jam because they had a problem when they fell, and not in a way that they could get back up, right? And so I look at these things and I see the kind of things we're doing with health records, and I just think we're on the cusp of a very long path to helping people. And if you can help people, you can build a big business out of that.
That was Apple Chief Executive Tim Cook speaking to CNBC. Now, that clip is from a few years ago, but he's reiterated that in recent weeks and kind of talking about how in 100 years' time, when people look back at Apple, it might be healthcare where actually they've made the most difference. And for example, the fall detection he mentioned, you can see how that's a good idea. The watch sort of rings the emergency services if it detects you've had a fall and you aren't moving. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see how they develop and just how much of people's lives Apple gets involved in.
Gavin, as always, thank you very much. A great pleasure. That is Gavin McLaughlin, News Talk's Deputy Business Editor.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.